Okay, tonight I'm going to talk on metta. That's one of the four Brahmaviharas, or divine abiding, so-called. In Buddhism, as you know, there are a great many meditation subjects. There are, in fact, 40 in all, and there are these four which are given a group all to themselves. They are metta, or loving kindness. Perhaps an equally good translation is patience. There is karuna, or compassion, something which you always hear in connection with the Buddhist way. There's mudita, sympathetic joy, or gladness in other people's achievement. And upekkha, which is equanimity. They're all practiced in a somewhat similar way. And tonight I want to give you an outline of how best to approach the practice of metta, loving kindness, or patience. It might be as well first to ask why it is we wish to do this. These divine abidings, these Brahmaviharas, are specific counters to certain psychological states. Metta, or loving kindness, is the specific counter for hatred or ill will. It's the specific counter for impatience. And so if you suffer from hatred, if you suffer from impatience, then metta is an exceedingly useful thing to develop. Karuna, or compassion, is the specific antidote to cruelty or simple non-feeling for one's fellow human beings. Gladness, mudita, is a very good counter for contempt, looking down upon other people, which again is problem that's common to many, many individuals in this world of ours. And equanimity, of course, is the specific counter for all forms of agitation. How then do we start? The most important thing to recognize is that we cannot abandon disadvantages or gain advantages that we are unaware of. So the way in which one starts one's metta practice is to review the disadvantages of hatred or impatience. Having done that, one then goes on to review the advantages of loving kindness or patience before one even makes any further attempts at development of this kind. And this is something that's done before every practice of this particular meditation. So, what are the disadvantages of hatred? Quite simply, if you are angry or hateful, you tend to turn in on yourself. You tend to stop contacting other people. You sit, perhaps, or stand and frown and refuse to meet other people's eyes. If it gets more intense, then you're likely to actually speak harsh words to people, to favour them with a look which would probably wither and kill if you had the power behind it. It goes even further, perhaps, to actual physical violence. It certainly is often shown up by setting little traps for people, either verbally or in other ways too, out of sheer dislike for that particular individual. It can, of course, end up with you perhaps killing another living thing or another person, and in turn, you are likely to be damaged yourself, either by being put in jail or perhaps even executed. If that excuse me, if that sounds rather strong, bear in mind that all violence of the kind of which I've been speaking comes from the root of hatred, and much of hatred shows in impatience. I'm sure some of you have owned or do own dogs and take them out for walks and that sort of thing. What happens when they won't do what you say? Do you not get exceedingly angry, impatient with the animal because it seems to be willfully disobeying, and then come the thoughts of giving it a good hiding or whatever? Natural resultants from the state of anger and hatred that's arisen. Similarly, with those of you who have young children or know people with young children, and I mean babies more than young kids, when they continually cry and cry and cry and cry, the temptation is so strong it's almost possible not to overcome it by any effort on your part. The kid keeps screaming and the temptation is to hit it. And indeed, the battered baby syndrome is one that's terribly easy to understand when you're at the end of your tether and this little thing still keeps on squalling and squalling, you can't seem to do anything for it in any way. Then the natural reaction is for anger and hatred to arise and the wish to dispatch that thing as quickly as possible, to get it to shut up in some way. All of these, then, are disadvantages of anger, disadvantages of hatred. Something then worth getting rid of, something worth overcoming. What are the advantages then in the practice of metta? There are, quoted in the books, 11 specific advantages. Such a person practicing metta and developing it well always sleeps easily. He goes to sleep as though he's meditating, quietly, calmly, and with no fuss or bother. He sleeps well. He doesn't have any bad dreams. When he wakes up, he's bright, alert, and on the ball, and doesn't groan and toss and turn and come up to the surface all red-eyed and unable to face the day. He wakes cleanly and with little fuss. A person who practices metta is very well liked by other people, by human beings. Because practicing metta is to practice friendliness towards others. You could say, if you like, it's developing a friendly attitude. And a friendly attitude promotes a similar response. And thus, if you maintain an attitude of friendliness, you find that you too are treated with friendliness. You are dear to human beings in that way. Similarly, you're dear to non-human beings, devas and the like. They will tend to look out for you where that is possible, because practicing harmlessness, as it's sometimes also called, is regarded very highly by all beings. Also, you'll find that one of the advantages is that you very seldom, if ever, come into contact with violence yourself. It's unlikely that you'll be harmed by any weapons or any fighting of any kind. Again, for the same reasons, the practice of metta. So there are some, at least, of the advantages of practicing this way. And those, as you can see, are all fairly mundane. In addition, however, it enables the mind to concentrate extremely easily and quickly. Now, that's a benefit not to be sneered at for the meditator, because to be able to gain a concentrated state easily and quickly, to put the hindrances on one side, just like that, can be of tremendous benefit for a comfortable life. The advantages then should be reviewed before the practice of metta even begins. Indeed, one must say that the review of the disadvantages and the advantages, the disadvantages of hatred, the advantages of loving kindness, are an integral part of the practice of metta. How then do we actually go on to develop it from that point? Now, this is loving kindness towards all beings. Where do we start? We start with ourselves. If you cannot get a feeling of friendliness going for yourself, you will never get it going toward other people. Now, that sometimes can be difficult, insofar as we often tend to underestimate ourselves or see only our faults and our bad side. To practice metta, it is imperative that you do not dwell on what you consider to be your faults, but rather consider your better side. And it's easiest, perhaps, to start if you can remember some incident in the past when you yourself felt a strong love or a strong friendliness for someone or something. Utilizing memory in this way, we can recapture at least the taste of the feeling that goes along with the loving kindness and use that as a basis on which to work. What we do then, what we want to do, is to develop for ourselves a feeling of friendliness, a feeling of, if you like, patience with ourselves. We tend, some of us, don't we, to be very, very impatient with ourselves. We want to whip ourselves into shape as quickly as possible, preferably yesterday. And as we all know, that doesn't work terribly well. All that happens is we get more and more tense. If we adopt a gentler attitude, then it is indeed possible to develop the feeling of warmth, feeling of friendliness, a feeling of love, not sticky sentimental love, but a reasonable, non-harming approach to one's whole being, mind and body. There are a number of ways in which this can be assisted, and one of them is to center that feeling of warmth which can develop in this way in the solar plexus region. And with every breath, with every in-breath, feel as though that warmth is spreading throughout the body, warming and relaxing the body as it goes. Sometimes it helps, and this depends upon really the type of person you might be, sometimes it helps to visualize as occurring in the abdominal area a flame, perhaps a small candle flame initially, which is imbued with warmth and this loving kindness. And with each in-breath, that candle flame expands, becomes bigger, more lambent, more translucent, and spreads its warmth, the warmth of metta, throughout the body, until you come to a point where you visualize yourself sitting entirely inside this flame, warmed thoroughly by it. Now, this particular stage, in other words, getting the feeling of warmth, whether accompanied by visualization or not, can take a little while. It can take repeated attempts. And it's well worth persevering with it. I know when I first started metta, I pretty well despaired of ever being able to do it. I thought I was such a rotten sort one way and another. But with persistence and apparently no results at all for weeks and weeks and weeks and months on end, with persistence, it gradually came about. It took time, it took persistence, it took doggedness, but it does work. And it's one of those things, like Vipassana meditation, if you apply yourself properly, it has to work. It has to work, because it's the outcome of a due process. Okay, so when you've got it running, then you are in a position to start directing this metta towards another person. Now, perhaps this is the point at which to say that one of the objectives of practicing metta to its fullest extent is to get to the chana levels, the fixed meditation levels, where anything that one does put into effect is that much more powerful. There is no way that one can generate that sort of intensity toward oneself alone. The best one can possibly hope to do practicing metta towards oneself is to get to what we call access concentration, where the hindrances are suppressed. But it's still not fixed meditation, it's not as powerful. If one wants to develop the strong form then of metta, one has to do that by applying it to another person, another individual, or another group of beings. The kinds of people towards whom one might practice metta are, for convenience, divided up into four. We have the respected friend or associate, someone who is very near and dear to us, very close indeed, someone who is an acquaintance, effectively a neutral person, someone for whom one has no particular feelings one way or the other, and someone who one can classify as an enemy, someone for whom one feels hatred or contempt. It would be exceedingly difficult, I think you'll agree, to try and develop loving kindness towards someone for whom we feel the most intense hatred as a starting point. Yeah? So there is a best order in which to take these various individuals. If you take someone who's very close to you, you find that you get tangled up with memories and thoughts about past times and possible future times. There are lots and lots of distractions with someone who's very close. So the best person to start with is a respected friend or associate, someone whom you like, of course, someone whose good points you can see and document if you feel so inclined. And what one does is, there are a number of different ways of developing the metta, which I'll come on to in a moment, but what one does is get this strong feeling going toward that person and seeing them as being well, seeing them as being happy, and bathing them in the warmth of this metta. When you can get that going with some strength towards that individual, then you are in a position to move on to the next kind of person, someone who is very close, very near to you, very dear to you. When you have come to some success with the metta for such an individual, you can then move on to the next, the neutral acquaintance. And again, it's possible to get the metta running for such a person just as strongly as you got it going towards the very first person you tried. Finally, and this is the difficult one, developing metta towards an enemy, someone whom you actually hate. Very often the best that can be achieved is to reduce the enemy to the status of a neutral acquaintance. In other words, you banish the hatred, but are left only with a neutral feeling. You don't really get the positive feeling of friendliness towards them. How then does one in fact go about developing metta towards any other person? There are a number of different things you can do to aid you in this. Sometimes, of course, it springs up spontaneously, and that's all to the good. But assuming it doesn't, then you might, for example, recollect gifts that person has given you, the kindnesses they may have shown you, the sterling qualities they may have. Certainly do not, under any circumstances, dwell on what you consider to be their faults. Leave those right out of the picture. We're only concerned about seeing people in the best possible light. It also helps enormously to visualize that person as looking well and happy, smiling, serene. And if you can do that bathed in this flame that we spoke of earlier, then you tend to redouble the effect. The important thing, however, is to see the person as well and happy. You might repeat a formula to yourself: may so and so be well, may they be happy, may they be free from suffering, may they achieve their heart's desire, something like that. The difficulty with such a formula is that it gets very quickly into a rote repetition if you're not careful, and that's to be avoided at all costs. There are two so-called enemies of metta. There's a near enemy and a far enemy, and it depends actually what kind of character type you are as to which is the near one and which is the far one. So let's just take them without reference to which is first. One enemy of metta is sensuality. If you are practicing metta, particularly of course towards somebody of the opposite sex, it's very, very easy, if you're not careful, to slip over into sensuality, sensual longing for that particular individual. That, of course, is miles away from the friendliness that we intend by this metta practice, and therefore should be counteracted. Counteracted at that time by stopping the metta towards, of course it's no longer metta, towards that person, and going on to somebody else. Indeed, it's recommended that in the early stages you do not develop metta towards a member of the opposite sex, simply because there is that likelihood. But this is something you can find out for yourselves. The other enemy of metta is ill will, or irritation, hatred if you like. Some of us see the world in a rather more negative way than do others, and we see very easily the supposed faults of another. Trying then to practice metta, we find that what keeps popping up for us is the faults of the other person, and before we know where we are, we're thoroughly irritated, indeed quite angry with that person. So we've slipped away from our pure practice of loving kindness and have fallen by the wayside based on this enemy of the practice. There's one fellow we used to know, of whom our teacher used to say, yes, he regularly lashes the world with metta. And indeed it's easy to do if you're not careful and you're not mindful. Another meditator that we know personally, she's set up her metta using this flame idea that I was mentioning earlier. And she used to place the people she was directing her metta towards in the flame and bathe them with its soft and warm light, the light of metta, loving kindness. And she was doing this for her sister one day when that gentle, lambent flame turned into a roaring furnace and consumed her sister, leaving nothing but a pile of charred bones behind. Guess which enemy of metta was in operation? Sometimes it's hard to get rid of resentment or irritation towards someone you're trying to practice metta on, so there are a number of ways in which you can do that. You can reflect that the worst thing you can possibly do is in fact to get angry, to get hateful, to get irritated, because it's that very thing which will please your enemies most. A person, when they have hate running, is very ugly and usually most unwelcome in any community, in any small group, in any group at all, come to that. Their reputation suffers, they experience painful feelings, they in short do themselves all kinds of damage, not just in the present but also in the future. Because hatred is, of course, an inefficient action and has unpleasant and painful resultants in the future. So if you do allow hatred, ill will, irritation, resentment to run, then you're doing the very thing that your enemies would most like you to do, hurting yourself. That's often quite effective, depending upon one's turn of mind. Or you could reflect that the thing with which the person with whom you're angry is in fact nothing but a series of conditioned phenomena, and which bit is it that you're angry with? In other words, where is this person with whom you're angry? Do an analysis into, say, elements or something like that to try and allay the resentment. Or alternatively, you usually find that most people, if we take action as divided into three kinds, body, speech and mind, mostly, people are not all bad. In fact, I would go so far as to say no one ever is all bad. But they may well have an unfortunate way of acting in terms of speech, but be perfectly okay in their bodily action and in their mental action. So one completely excludes from the reckoning their verbal action, which is indeed not as it should be, and only concentrates on the attention on the bodily and the mental action, saying how good these are, what value actions of this sort are. Leave out the one negative side. This too can help to allay resentment. I think I'll move on from different ways of allaying resentment and go on to the ways in which one might also apply metta. I've talked so far only about practicing it towards individual human beings. I should perhaps add one thing before we move on. If you are intending to practice this to the full, in other words, get to the chanas based on the practice of metta, then it will never work if you practice it towards someone who is dead. It has to be a living, breathing person. And I'll move on to the other ways now. Rather than choosing just one person, you can choose to practice metta towards all beings. All beings, whether they be near or far, in high or low position, whether they're born or unborn, whether they're short or tall, fat or thin, whether they walk, crawl, swim, fly, all breathing, living beings. You don't have then to specify where these are, because it's pretty inclusive, all living beings. One makes the determination, may all living beings be well, may all living beings be happy, and you try again to generate this feeling of warmth towards everything that's alive. And that's from viruses, if you like, right up to the highest gods and everything in between. Also, one can choose a directional approach to the practice, and this is sometimes quite useful. You can say, may all beings to the north be well and happy, to the south, to the west, to the east, in the upward direction and in the downward direction. And again, following the same sort of pattern. Devising for yourself a little formula which should not become just a rote repetition, but should be thought through and meant as far as that is possible. Or one can take individual classes of being. May all men, may all women be happy, may all animals be happy, may all policemen be happy, because I was done to the other week. You might find occasion then for directing metta towards a specific kind of individual. Or, one which I particularly favour, but that's a purely a personal preference, you might develop this flame that we spoke of, so that you see yourself as sitting in it, and then, having got that far, you then determine to expand that flame to a considerably greater size. You should actually delimit the size to which you intend to extend it before you do so. So, for example, one sees oneself sitting in this flame, then says, okay, next thing I'm going to do is include the whole room. So you then expand that flame to fill the whole room, and you say, may all beings in this area, or this volume, be well, may they be happy, in just the same way as you did before. But now we've got a sort of three-dimensional approach. Do you see what I mean? It's a spatial one rather than a person-orientated thing. Having done that, you can then expand it to include the whole house and go through the same formula again, then to include perhaps the whole street, the whole village, the whole county, the whole country, the world, the solar system, and indeed infinity is the limit. And then you should reverse the direction and bring it back in the same steps each time, until you end up with yourself sitting in a flame, and then you reduce that flame to a small candle flame which burns eternally in the middle of your body. So it's always there to be called upon. Purely conceptual, of course, but a very, very useful device indeed in this regard. So there are then a number of different ways of practicing metta. Let's just recap over what we've covered this evening. The reasons for metta practice are for ease of living here and now, and that covers those 11 advantages of which I spoke, not least of which is sleeping easily, but it also of course aids, as I said, with concentration. It means that you get on well with people, you get on well with beings, to be less specific. And it reminds me of a tale our teacher had to tell when he was up in the forests of northern Thailand. He spent some time meditating in a cave, and going on Pindapar begging Ram to the village each morning for his food. When he got back to the forest, he found that there were some of the animals around who were particularly interested in the food that he had, one of them being a young bear, who presumably had been orphaned in some way. But this bear became so tame that Kapi was able to feed it, and it used to hang around quite a lot of the time. When finally Kapi came to leave the area, he was about to leave the village, and the villagers said, "Oh, you must go back and say goodbye to the bear." And so he did that, and he found the bear waiting for him at the usual spot where he left the forest, and came back in again with his food. And this bear used to put his fingers in his mouth, and the bear would suck his fingers. And the villagers were delighted by this, and they knew, and rightly, that it was because of Kapi's practice of metta towards the animals of the forest that this could come about at all. On another occasion, he was sitting meditating in front of the cave, and he suddenly felt as though he were being watched. And he opened his eyes, and there sitting in front of him was a male baboon, boss of a particular troop of baboons, staring straight at him and going, with his teeth. But again, no problems, because there's one of the things that metta does is to eradicate fear of other beings, fear of animals. And so when there's no fear reflex, there's no danger. Like when he was also sleeping and felt something going over his leg, woke up to find that it was a python, a boa constrictor, crawling over his leg. Well, wisely he didn't move, because he reasoned that the snake regarded him just as another surface. And so, again, that passed off with no danger at all. But all of these things have very much greater impact if you cast them in the light of loving-kindness meditation. So ease of living, then, is a very potent factor, one which I think would drive anyone toward the practice of metta. For a meditator, the overcoming of the hindrances is clearly important, and indeed this particular practice will take you as far as the third of the four rupa jhanas, if developed to the full. It also aids in the development of the paramis, or perfections, amongst which are generosity, patience, and patience is metta. And all of these aid one in one's daily living, and they also aid one's whole approach to meditation. With the ability to concentrate the mind easily, any kind of meditation is thereby facilitated. One spends less time torn with thoughts and agitations, and settles more quickly to whatever it is that one is doing. And that's true just as much on the Vipassana path as it is on any concentration meditation path. It also assists in the development of the Eightfold Path. If you practice metta, loving kindness, patience, you're much more likely to practice right speech, right thought. In other words, you don't entertain thoughts of hatred for other people, so it's aided in that regard. Right action becomes facilitated. You're far less likely to do things associated with hatred if there is metta to hand, so to speak. And it also, of course, helps in right livelihood. Someone who has made a particular effort with metta practice is most unlikely to go into the business of, say, manufacturing weapons or dealing in drugs. The abuse of drugs, that is. I'm not talking about doctors, obviously. And so it helps in that respect. And of course it also helps with right concentration, another factor on the Eightfold Path. So the help which metta can bring is frankly phenomenal. I'm not suggesting that it's necessarily easy to develop, because it is certainly quite a struggle in the early stages to get it going properly. But it is very, very well worthwhile attempting. So one has to review the disadvantages of anger, hatred, impatience, one then has to review the advantages of metta, then set it up towards oneself. May I be well, may I be happy. Having got it going toward oneself, then one develops metta towards someone who is a respected associate or friend, not too close, but respected. Having got that going, one then directs the metta towards a close friend, a very dear friend. Having understood how to do that, one then develops metta towards the neutral person, and finally towards the one who could be called an enemy, someone whom you dislike intensely. When you can practice metta to all those four, with no distinction between them, then you are said to have broken the barrier. And to try and illustrate that, there's a story about a group of monks in the forest, all of whom were practicing metta. Some bandits came and caught them, and they wanted to take just one of this number of monks away to kill him. Why, I don't know, but that's what they wanted to do. Now put yourself in the position, you're one of a band of monks in the forest, and you suddenly, in a group, you're caught and told that one of your number is to be taken away to be killed. You have to decide who should go. If you decide on somebody else, that means you don't like that person particularly, whichever way you go. If you decide on yourself, then you don't like yourself particularly. If you refuse to make a decision, if you cannot see anyone who should be taken away to be killed, even under that sort of threat, then you've broken the barrier. And most people's reaction is either to say, oh, we won't miss him very much, or I'll let them take me. I'll make the noble sacrifice. So breaking the barrier is rather more subtle than perhaps at first it appears. And I'll leave you with one story called the Parable of the Saw. Gautama said that even if bandits should set upon you and saw off your limbs with a two-handed saw, if any one of you under such treatment should allow one spark of hatred to enter your mind, you are not monks of mine. That's only possible with metta.